You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Diane Lewis, who lives and works in Manhattan. Lewis is the first Cooper architect to have been awarded the Rome Prize in Architecture. We're going to talk a little bit about her work as well as monographs. Diane, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'd like to ask you a little bit about the upcoming monograph, Existential Urbanity, as well as previous ones. Can you tell me a little bit about that book, which, as I understand it, is about your history of teaching?
Right. Well, to begin with, I completed a monograph of my architectural practice, which started independently in 1984. And that book goes from 84 to the year 2008. And I worked with Carta Milano, which is a fantastic art book company. And I had, after I did my architectural work, I decided to continue and do a book with them of the 14 years of teaching the studio on the city, which is unique to the manner that I teach it at Cooper, with a group of really wonderful architects I invited to teach with me. So that spans from the end of John Haydock's deanship at Cooper Union to the present, which was the period of Anthony Vidler's deanship. So it will cover the time, a very important time in the history of the Cooper Union School of Architecture, which is unique. So I call the book Open City, Existential Urbanity, because, as you said, I was very privileged to go to Cooper and then win the Rome Prize at a time where the Italian sensibility on the art of building the city was a very integrated and intensely intimate discussion among architects like the ones that I was educated and then became colleagues with, like John Haydock, Raymond Abraham, Aldo Rossi, Richard Meyer, and artists like Constantino Nivola, who worked with BBPR, et cetera. So there's a kind of culture of this idea of the city as a composite work of art between architects and artists, which also relates to probably why you invited me, having taught at Yale in that capacity from 1978 to 82 and then 87, 88, and 89, you know, again. So I don't know, it's the Yale. It seems like you're calling me from a kind of Yale base, and I taught there for many years.
Let's talk a little bit about what was happening around the time when you won the Rome Prize. That really very special time in history, or it's certainly unique, the way you describe the interaction of artists and architects. What was happening with you at that time that you think allowed you to be awarded that, you know, very prestigious prize at a time where I would think there was also, you know, a good amount of sexism in that field? And,
yes.
You know, it's kind of extraordinary. So
yeah, it was unbelievable because I was like 24 when I got it. And at the time I studied, it's a very important period, and I think, and I'm very germane to, I think, the issues you cover. First of all, I think when you take a really heavy conceptual artist, like Sarah and my friend Carl Andre, and who, Double Negative, is Michael Heiser, and Robert Smithson, and you really look at what they were doing. Many of them were in Italy studying like 10, 15 years before me, and they all had the Fulbright at the same time John Haydock did, and you know, there was this whole connection sort of between a kind of post-war Milanese modern and Roman innovations and a kind of idea of the architect as an auteur, architect who was responsible not only for form but for social program in a kind of incredibly innovative way. At the same time, these artists were understanding the challenge of Meissian and Corbusian space, and they were going back to ancient origins of form, and they were interested in long span, you know, sites where they were challenging the banality or the convention of architecture, while you had these poetic architects looking at a whole other aspect of involvement in architecture. So you had this incredible dialogue, which led into the kind of Arte Povera movement. I mean, there's roots in there. So that was sort of the generation that educated me. And I started in the art school at Cooper Union, and I studied with Ed Reinhardt's protege and the Bauhaus guys. Ed Reinhardt's protege was Francis Hewitt of the group Anonima. And I studied with the actual Bauhaus guys. So I had a firsthand experience of the roots of where these other people were coming from. So when I got to Rome, I was in this incredible forum of architects who were like the movie directors, like the auteurs, and worried about all sorts of aspects of social responsibility and participation and the language of the modern movement, as well as the spatial innovation of the free plan, as well as understanding the conceptual artist. So that's what I came out of. And I think that's why, you know, my experience at Yale was that, you know, I taught there. Cesar Pelli brought me in right out of Rome. And then when John Haida came, he asked me to do the Davenport studio with him. And then a few years later, Frank Gehry had me do the Davenport studio with him for 2 or 3 years, where we brought in the graduate artists and architects together to do urban projects that were poetic and radical. Does that give you the background?
Yeah, it does. And it still seems to me that, you know, at that time, you must have felt very powerful to be in that scene. When I've talked to other artists around that time, Mary Heilman, other women who are trying to also become part of the New York scene then, they said it was very difficult to get into what seemed kind of like an impenetrable boys' club of ego and even materiality.
I'm like 10 years younger than, so I wasn't, at that age, I didn't feel anything of the male, I didn't feel anything about male chauvinism. I was oblique to it. I was a pretty radical student, and I was treated among the architects I studied with as, I mean, you know, as a serious, I remember once Richard Meier was screaming at me, and everybody was jealous because he was giving me such a hard time. It was like he believed I could do it, and you know, I never had that feeling. I mean, now, you know, many, many years later, I see what it meant to pass through certain gates and also not to get through others. But I'd say my life has been pretty unique in the sense that I was also the first woman architect tenured at Cooper Union, and maybe that was a big deal even to be tenured as a woman architect anywhere in this country at that time. So I was in 1990. So I don't know. I haven't focused that much on the repression of the feminine in my architectural life. I feel has been pretty liberated in the sense that what I've been interested in advancing as a position is radical enough that it's even difficult for men to advance the position. I mean, most people look at lady architects just see if they can be like powerful corporate builders, but if you want to be a kind of conscious critical practice as a female and be acknowledged as an artist in terms of the spatiality and the poetry that is continuous with Mies and Korb and various other great people that have defined the discipline, that's radical and hard to do even if you're a man. And then to try to do it as a woman is considered like, oh my God. And certainly I have tried to really work carefully on, you know, I've accepted specific conditions of being a New York architect and see it in a bigger context, an ancient context, a Roman context, an Italian context. It's been such a European dialogue in my life. But most of all, I'm interested in a kind of completely continuous life among artists in terms of really imagining the city as an intimate space for radical social program. And that's really been, you know, that's a big subject because, you know, it's been very controversial in the last 20 years, where there are really architects who believe they can do like radical Mercedes-Benz showrooms, if you understand what I'm saying.
I do, but let's focus on that a little bit then. What would be an example of that? And maybe we can talk about it through an early client of yours where you were trying to put some of these notions into practice. I mean, to me, that also seems to come out of you know, the zeitgeist perhaps of the 60s and 70s, this idealism. Is there an early client you could talk about or an experience that brought together some of that notion of the social fabric and artist that you're talking about?
Well, that's an interesting question. Let me think. I mean, the first things that I worked on when I first left I.M. Pei's office, I was really, you know, it's such a magical thing as to how you become an architect and how you get an independent practice. I mean, I was really dedicated in my apprenticeship in the Meyer office where I did really careful urban plans that he did the Mondev project, which I worked on him on, with. And then I went to Pei's office and I did 499 Park Avenue, which was the design of a glass skyscraper, which was under James Ingo Fried, who was Mies van der Rohe's student, and it's, you know, 8 blocks away from the Seagram's building. So basically we were building a kind of answer, a lot line answer to the Seagram's building. So I got to work with Jim, who's now deceased, but one of the great people to work with, a real Miesian, brilliant, liberated, problem-giving mind. So I left that, and I immediately had project like, I got a really fantastic television studio to design originally under a client that I.M. Pei's office gave me, who as a kind of goodbye gift, and his he was Jules Dassin's cousin, the director, and he owned a building which was called the Madison Square Mission House, which was a cube built in the 1890s, and I designed a radical transformation of it as a television and film studio, and it has a kind of moat around it, and I proposed these exoskeletal towers of elevator, stair, et cetera, and this kind of long-span interior space, including two-story spaces, and there were even a sort of school for young people to come and do video and film. And that was really the first commission I did out of working for these larger, you know, I.M. Pei's office was a very, like, Rolls-Royce corporate office, but my first project was this film and TV studio. And it was a beautiful project, and it was so enticing that he actually wound up having a developer want to buy the building and knock it down, and then, you know, it was like everybody was so interested in the project that it outdid itself, and he wound up selling off the land and making a fortune. And the building was demolished, and we didn't do the project. And that's interesting because the works you actually build as opposed to the works that you study and propose are equal in the long run. And the drawings are there, and the concepts are there, and they come and go, and they continue in the built and the unbuilt work.
You know, it's almost a transformational idea, this idea of, you know, architecture affecting how artists operate, even that idea of studios for people to make video at a time when, you know, video art and everything was just beginning. That would have been a cultural contribution and a way of tying so much together. Was there another project, perhaps a gallery or something else that you designed?
At that time, I was also doing, I mean, I did many, many art galleries through the 80s. I was also the architect for a project called the Kunsthalle New York, which was another project of mine that dealt with an idea that's now been sort of realized by Norman Foster with the Hearst building, where I took Beethoven Hall and invented this light layer atelier lid that went dropped down into the building and sliced this kind of 19th century bearing wall building so that the ground floor was suspended and there were sort of doors that rolled down and the sidewalk became a kind of mezzanine that looked down into what had previously been a film studio. So the upper level had 360-degree skylights and the bottom had this fantastic two-story film studio in the East Village. And it was I was selected in competition with, you know, every major architect you can name at the time. And we started in 1991 and the board of that selected me was Achille Bonita Oliva, Adelina von Furstenberg, and it was just a total, it was an amazing group of clients I had on that. And unfortunately, they never raised the money for the project to be completely fulfilled. But part of the building burned down, and I actually redesigned the upper part so that the upper level was an exterior courtyard with 30-foot high brick walls. And we did an installation of many artists up there with no roof on it for a couple of years. So there, you know, I've been able to sort of turn every project. I mean, as we're working on it, I've worked on really radical projects for clients who are making things happen that even if they don't completely happen, like the whole process is part of aspiring to completely new levels of integration of, you know, unforeseen program and extensive spatial continuum of public space, civic space with art. I won the competition to save the Paul Rudolph Riverview building, which is like a Miesian steel building built in the 60s, and I advocated to become a music conservatory and have an inflatable roof over the courtyard and bring in Itzhak Perlman's Suncoast Young People's Concerts there and things like that. So, you know, it's been, practice is really wild in that sense that you have all this possibility of integrating these marvelous resources in people and, you know, transforming like the necessary conditions into something very poetic and very spatial and radically, you know, a vision of extensive space for the city, but an intimate one with works of art. So, you know, I can go through all the projects and go on and on, but it's such a marvelous work, and the teaching is part of it, because being involved with art and architecture students simultaneously, as well as your own colleagues who are artists and architects, to teach together and to really run a laboratory. Like right now I'm doing a project with my students which is called Cutouts 2015, based on the Matisse cutouts. And that project is about coming, I saw the show at MoMA. I mean, there's a huge story about the cutouts in my life. I
wanted to ask also, you know, in the context of what you're about to say, as you know, we're talking about what you've done as an architect and who you've worked with, as you're teaching, I'm also interested in how your ethic and your theories are creating this new generation of architects, and if they're interpreting that in their own way, and if so, how? I mean, it's kind of a large question, but that feeds into how are you teaching, essentially. So, yeah, by all means, let's talk about the history of Cutout and that project of your students
now.
Well,
that's going to lead, that sort of ties everything together. I mean, it's in around 1973 or 4, John Hedick was the dean of Cooper, and he mounted this idea that he was going to do a course called Cutouts. And none of the architects knew what it meant. I had been obsessed with Matisse's jazz book from the time I was 12 years old, and I knew what the cutouts was, so I told everybody I knew, sign up for this course. And all my friends signed up. And on the second day of the course, I had an elder boyfriend that said, oh, come on, you know, don't join the course because you're better than me and I have to graduate, so don't go. Please let me do it. You'll have your time. And so I didn't go. And John Hedick decided to take all the students who were in the room to Switzerland, and that's when he went to meet Aldo Rossi in Switzerland. So he took 10 students, and Aldo Rossi brought 10 students from Milan, and that was the beginning of the relationship, and he brought Rossi back to New York. And then I was exposed to all of these arguments about the nature of the city, the architecture of the city, which was the argument of that time, which I've already begun to outline for you, which in my view has to do with a kind of view of the auteur, you know, the whole aspect of the continuum of civic program and the re-energization, the re-envisioning of it by great architects, and that has to do with form and program and structure. So being bathed in this kind of debate, I went back in the Cutouts course and did a Cézanne house. I mean, Hedick gave the project as Cutouts, and then he had Cézanne, Matisse, Picasso, Braque, Juan Gris, and Leger. And you had to pick one, and then the word house, and you had to do a house. So I did a Cézanne house, and one day he said, that's the best one in the school. And then I went to teach at Yale when Pelley invited me, and then Hedick came and taught the Davenport studio, and he invited me to teach with him. And then he said to me at the end, I want you to come back to Cooper Union and teach Cutouts. And so I did. And at the time I did it, I then added many artists to it and started to expand it into abstract expressionism, into Rauschenberg, and into some of the more conceptual artists, and Duchamp. I did, and then I called it Ready Mades for a year. And then Pierre Restany came, and he just loved what I was doing. And he was amazed at the studio work I got out of this Cutouts course. So it became a kind of thing that I was developing, and I think Frank Gehry invited me to do the Davenport studio with him directly. I'd never met him, and he called me and said, come to Yale and do this with me. And I think it's because he knew that I was doing the Cutouts and that Hedick had started it. So later I won the Frank Gehry International Chair in Architectural Design in Toronto, and I taught there in that chair that's named after Mr. Gehry in his hometown. And Frank knew I was there, and he was excited about it. And I did another kind of based on Cutouts studio in Toronto for the students to really look at works of art, and I included Francis Bacon and Ed Reinhardt and a whole bunch, and Barnett Newman, and I blew it into a whole other area, Sarah. And I got them to do projects for the civic space that are really interesting ideas about what kind of civic function, at what scale and what grain, inspired by not only the works or the theories, but the actual works of art and the actual acts of making them and the writings of the artists. So this year, when the Matisse show came to MoMA, some wonderful friend of mine took me there for this New Year's Eve banquet, and I was like alone in the galleries with the cutouts in New Year's Eve with a friend of mine, and we were there, and with like only 30 people from all over the world, and I thought, this is it, it's knocking on my door. I'm going to do another cutout studio. It's Cutouts 2015. But this time I realized that he really did bring all of the things to bear on a chapel, and the Matisse chapel comes out of the cutouts, and I gave them the problem of the still life, because that's the first cutout. And if you really look...
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt you for a minute. Okay. The Matisse Chapel, I mean, you're mentioning, I've actually been to that chapel, and it's such a gorgeous little space, the way the light comes in there. You're saying it comes out of the cutouts because of the forms he used and how he drew on the walls there?
Yes, well, if you really study his exhibition, this exhibition on the cutouts, and like, first of all, this whole idea of the still life and the altar and the sacramental aspect of the altar, the chalice, the wine, the wafer, you know, the drape, there are all these aspects of the still life painting which have to do with the sacramental nature of the church. And then there's the cape itself, which comes out of the word chapel. One of my former students, colleagues, François de Menil, came and brought the book on Avon's chapel. His family was involved with it, and the priest Couturier, who tried to bring 20th century art into the dialogue with the church, including Ronchamp and La Tourette and the works of all sorts of artists all over Europe in that movement of bringing radical abstract art into the church. So there's a direct continuum with this idea of the chapel, the cape, the still life. And I gave the students this idea of starting with a still life and being able to imagine it as the city, which is something that's very germane to the kind of existential, sacramental aspect of the architecture of the city movement of the 80s. I mean, you know, Aldo Rossi did all those wonderful drawings of the still life of the city, and I've always brought this sense of discipline of the painting and the slab of the still life into the work that I do architecturally. So there's an austerity and there's a examination of not only the space but of the dramatis personae of the elements that an architect designs and how they position them in space. And this is an incredible provocation to the architectural imagination, which is to imagine the still life as the city, and also to imagine it as the components of a particular project, like a chapel or a particular program, a library, whatever. You have this ability to suspend scale and to enter into the internal implications of elements and their forms, and then to think of them structurally and poetically. So the project is a cutouts project for a chapel this semester, and they've started with these still lifes, and they're transforming them through certain studies in order to propose what they define as a chapel in any part of the globe, in any city, that has to do with a particular, maybe a commemoration of an event that's religious or a particular ceremonial condition inspired by the former, inspired by the reasons that chapels have been cited throughout the memory of architecture.
That's fantastic, and I'm so glad you brought that in, because that does tie everything together, and that's a particular favorite of mine. It's just such a gorgeous space. What's happening in the class now from that, too?
Well,
to bring
it was pretty exciting
together.
Yesterday. I mean, the thing that's amazing about, you know, the scene at Cooper, it's also, like, I'm very interested in the whole aspect of painting the paper and cutting it and having that edge on it. You know, Matisse pinned it, and it allows you to move these pieces of paper around like constructions or like sculpture or like carving them and cutting them. And it's architectural just to cut the pieces and move them and pin them and repin them and photograph them. So the paperwork and the wood models are all like models of space. So the cutouts are not only, you know, they have a magical quality where the edge conditions of these pieces that you cut and paint, sometimes they kind of curl up. The whole use of the black and white paint or the color paint, I mean, you've been to the Vons Chapel, so you know this idea of the edge, like the fact that he did those tiles with the black and white sort of incredibly calligraphic sketches of the Stations of the Cross, and then he invents cuts into the wall that pivot as stained glass shard windows. I mean, He's involved with different reflectivities. Every single element has its own character in the sort of table of urban space. I mean, this is where, you know, that's the kind of couture architecture, and I'm not talking about it in the sense that it's some fancy, expensive thing to participate. I'm saying the architect is like a tailor and can observe phenomena, and so is the artist, and the civic space can be so carefully enlivened by this dialogue between artists and architects, but it has to be, you know, it comes out of these people that really draw and think and read literature. I mean, we're in this incredibly technologically oriented critique of architecture right now where everybody's talking about sustainability, right? And the truth is, if you don't naturally understand sustainability as an architect, you're not an architect. I mean, where the sun comes from, the wind comes, the origins of the city, aqueducts, the whole aspect of understanding the sustaining forces, the structural forces of an empire, like a Roman empire, and how it transforms into contemporary architectural space, urban space, is something that has to come naturally to you. It's a given tool. But the aspect of diseño and of cutting and pasting and carving and sketching and bringing the imagination into the physical world, that's an alchemical, very deep process that artists and architects share, who really want to make things that glow in the light and sustain themselves throughout the memory of civilization. That's a very different set of values for for the critical view of architecture and practice. And you have to have a lot of careful relationships. And I think it's a beautiful thing I've always cared about in all these studio schools that I've taught is to really bring the artists and architects together to do work and to think things out, specifically from their own motivations and their own inspirations and the literary inspirations they have.
Diane, thank you so much for talking with us today. It's really a pleasure to hear everything that you're saying, and I feel that that wrapped it up so beautifully. Thank you.
Well, it's, you know, serendipitous and interesting that you should call me. I'm very appreciative, and I hope everybody will enjoy the book. It's coming out. There'll be a big symposium in the autumn. It's Open City, and it's also involved with the neorealist cinema and the city as an existential place of memory. So thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with The Art World Demystified.